And now, from Washington, the Inside Scoop. All the news the government does not want you to hear. Now, here's your host on the Inside Scoop, Mark Levine.
Good afternoon, America. Welcome to the Inside Scoop. We all know the words the media uses when discussing John McCain. Maverick, they call him, a straight talker, a moderate, a reformer. This is the guy who's the POW, the war hero. But what is the truth about John McCain? Is he as much of a maverick as the press says? Chris Matthews once famously said that the media loves John McCain so much they are his base. And certainly in this 2008 election season, we have seen John McCain treated with kid gloves. But what is the truth? Is he a straight talker? Does he flip-flop on issues from taxes to the war in Iraq, from Jerry Falwell to immigration, from abortion to such mundane things as ethanol? Is he a conservative? Is he a liberal? Does he have a lot of ties to lobbyists, the big business interests that have financed the Bush administration as well? To answer all these questions, I've invited Paul Waldman on the show. He is the co-author with David Brock of Free Ride, John McCain and the Media. Paul, welcome to the Inside Scoop.
Thanks, Mark.
Well, let me start with all the things that the media says about John McCain. Is it fair to say that John McCain is better treated than other politicians? I mean, doesn't the media praise other politicians?
I don't think there's any question that nobody has gotten the kind of sustained positive coverage that he has over the years. Other candidates and other politicians will get periods of good coverage and periods of bad coverage, times when they're up, times when they're down. The difference with John McCain is not just in the character of his coverage, which we're going to talk about, but also the fact that it's almost uninterrupted in its positivity. He's really seen for the last 10 or 12 years or so a kind of sustained wave of just positive coverage that building up this image of him that is precisely what he and his advisors want to create. So in the end, the press became almost partners with him in creating that image. Most of the things that are involved in that image are either wildly exaggerated or just outright false. But there's nobody who has kind of cracked the media code in the same way that John McCain has and gotten them on his side.
And we'll get to the details of all the things the media has false. But let me just ask you in general. No one would claim the media has been friendly to, say, Hillary Clinton, or even, for that matter, to Mitt Romney. But how about Barack Obama? At least until the Jeremiah Wright affair, it seems that he was getting sustained positive coverage. How would you compare Obama's coverage with McCain's?
Well, I think if you look over the course of this campaign, Obama has had some ups and some downs. There's certainly no question that he had periods of good coverage, especially when he was winning, and that's generally what you see. Since the political reporters look at almost everything through the perspective of that sort of who's up and who's down, tracking the poll results kind of thing, when a candidate wins primaries or an election, they ask why, and then they focus on the good things that they've done, or you know, the things that are working, the things that are resonating. When a candidate loses, then they ask why and focus on the things that they're doing wrong, the problems in their campaign, what's not being persuasive. So since he had this long string of victories, that really was the focus of their attention.
But John McCain, when John McCain, when he was losing, the media still liked him. That's the difference.
Yes, that exactly. That's the difference. I mean, let me give you an example. You know, John McCain went through a period where in 2007, where his campaign was really in a rut. And if you look at the coverage from that period, it was all sort of lamenting how awful it was that this fine man couldn't raise more money, couldn't have more success in the polls. None of the coverage was the kind of kick them when they're down sort of thing that we often see with other candidates.
And yeah, just to say, when Hillary Clinton and Barack Obama have been down respectively in this campaign, I saw a lot of kicking of both of them, but I didn't see people praising them and wishing they weren't down.
Exactly, and that's what we saw with McCain. And then as the Iowa caucus approached, something interesting happened. You started to hear commentators and reporters talk about how McCain was really coming back. He was poised for a comeback. And then just before the Iowa caucus, a lot of people on cable television and elsewhere were saying, well, if he can just pull 15% and maybe come in third, that'll be a real victory for him. And you could see them almost wishing and hoping for it. Well, what happened? Well, he won 13% in Iowa, and he came in fourth. But nonetheless, that night, there was all of these different people on television were talking about what a great victory it was for John McCain. Tim Russert immediately booked him for the next week's Meet the Press. It was truly extraordinary, despite his rather poor showing there. He was hailed as the victor. And I know that the people on the Huckabee campaign, Mike Huckabee was the one who actually won the Iowa caucus, you might remember, they were furious, right? Because they felt like they were being ignored, even though they were the ones who won, in favor of all this attention given to McCain, almost as though the reporters were just waiting for an excuse to pull him back up. And that's what happened.
It's interesting. You point out he got fourth. I guess Fred Thompson was third in Iowa. It's hard to remember now. Mitt Romney, I know, was second. That would make me think he was barely ahead of Ron Paul.
Yes, exactly. I think Romney may have gotten 10% and McCain got 13, something like that.
We're going to get, and we have a whole hour, so there's plenty of time to get the specifics. I want to go through all his various flip-flops and all the various adjectives, but I want to start at the beginning of the show by just talking in general the source of this media's love for John McCain. And I can think of two main sources. One is he was a POW, and so he was an honored war hero, and that's one source, although I would compare it to John Kerry and say, wasn't John Kerry a war hero? Why didn't he get the same positive treatment? And the other thing is the famous Straight Talk Express, the campaign of 2000. Let me start with the war hero stuff. Clearly, he was a war hero, right? But how does that compare to, say, John Kerry's treatment of his war experience?
Well, it's hard to overstate the importance of that story that it has on the press and their view of John McCain. You hear them mention it over and over and over. Whenever they're talking about him, whenever somebody raises a question about John McCain's character, whether it has even the things that have nothing to do with something that happened in Vietnam 40 years ago, the response from reporters often is, but the guy was a POW in Vietnam. He's a hero. How can you question his character? And of course, you know, what he went through in Vietnam, which nobody questions, is a part of his character. It's a part of his biography, but it's not the entirety of it.
But compare it to John Kerry, if you would, because John Kerry won, I forget how many Silver Crosses and Purple Hearts and Iron Stars, and I don't know all the military medals, but this was a man who'd won, John Kerry, as many medals, it seems, as the military can bestow. Why didn't John Kerry, 4 years ago, have this same image that John McCain has now?
Well, it was attacked from the get-go. And John Kerry, he won 3 Purple Hearts and a Bronze Star and a Silver Star. And there's kind of a default setting among Republicans that Democrats hate America. And so immediately they went after his service. You know, some extraordinary things happened. If you recall, at the Republican convention in 2004, one of the things that they were doing was they were questioning whether or not Kerry deserved his Purple Hearts. And so you had delegates to the Republican convention who came onto the floor wearing Band-Aids on their faces with a little Purple Heart drawn on the Band-Aid. And they said when they were questioned, oh, well, you know, I cut myself shaving, so I gave myself a Purple Heart. Ha, 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 ha. I mean, can you imagine what would have happened if the parties were reversed and that was a Democrats who were making fun of a Republican for the Purple Hearts that he won? I mean, it would have been front.
I can't imagine it.
Yeah, it would have been extraordinary. But the thing is that what you see with McCain is that the story of the fact that he was a POW gets dropped in all the time into press reports when it doesn't have anything to do with the subject at hand. You know, you'll read stories that say John McCain, who was a prisoner of war in Vietnam, today gave a speech on the economy. And you're thinking, what does that have to do with the fact that he gave a speech on the economy? And I think
so explain to me, if you can, what the difference is. And I don't know that I mean, it's a very tough question. That's why I'm asking you, because I have no answer. How is it that John Kerry, who won the 5 medals that you mentioned, some of the highest honors you can get, and, you know, clearly served his country in Vietnam, John McCain served his country, was a POW. How is it that John McCary was not treated to the same war hero status? What is it about? Is it John McCain that's unique, or was it John Kerry that was unique, or is it just that Republicans get these bona fides in ways that Democrats don't?
I think you're right on that last point. I think that any Democrat would have been attacked because, frankly, you know, that's what Republicans do, is they attack the patriotism of Democrats. And it would have been, if it had been a different Democrat with a similar war record,
but
it would have been a similar
story.
But there is
a whispering campaign similar to the Swift Boat attacks against John Kerry. And I have no reason to believe it's true, but there are people that whisper about John McCain and what he did as a prisoner of war. Again, I don't think it's true. But the whispering campaign against John Kerry, of course, was a few ads on TV, Swift Boats. I mean, do you see that same kind of thing happening to John McCain, or why not?
Here's the difference. All of those things, SWPO veterans, when reporters finally got around to investigating them, almost every charge SWPO veterans made against John Kerry was false. But they treated them as though they were serious accusations, and they talked about them endlessly for months before they finally got around to investigating them. With John McCain, you do have people out there who say that, you know, he betrayed the country. There's all kinds of crazy people,
right,
who have had these kind of whisper campaigns about John McCain, but reporters treat that as though those people are crazy, and they don't give them any credence, they don't give them any attention, they don't talk about their allegations. So there's a fundamental difference right at the starting point. Now, you know, Kerry obviously had a complicated story because he was a war hero, and then he came back and he protested against the war. McCain's service is very different. It's almost pure in a way because no matter how you felt about the war, you can honor that without any sort of reservations. You know, he went there, he was captured, he was tortured, he suffered. Okay. If you were for the war or against the war, you can honor that and not begrudge him any part of it. Whereas a lot of conservatives begrudge John Kerry the fact that he became a war opponent. But you find over and over again, especially among those reporters and commentators who are baby boomers, you find them mentioning John McCain's the fact that he was a POW and even admitting that part of it is guilt. That they, we have a quote from Chris Matthews in the book where on his show, Roger Simon, who's a longtime political reporter, was talking about how the press gives McCain lots and lots of breaks, and Matthews blurted out, because he went to Vietnam and a lot of us didn't.
It's guilt.
It is this kind
it's guilt
of
that they didn't feel with John Kerry, who also went to Vietnam when the media didn't. Let me ask you, though, if it's because John McCain has cultivated the media in a way that I think other politicians could merely dream about. His infamous Straight Talk Express bus, where, I mean, the image is, the myth, if you will, is that he was a guy who would talk about anything at the back of the bus. He would joke around with reporters and drink with them and tell them anything they wanted to hear, and he had such tremendous access. One thing I have noticed, though, is he is everywhere, whether it's The Daily Show with Jon Stewart to, of course, Meet the Press, to any of the, you know, the late night shows. It seems this is a guy who does seem to appear on the media more than other politicians. Is that part of it?
That is part of it, and that happened long before he ran for president again. We did a study on the appearances that people make on the Sunday shows like Meet the Press and Face the Nation. John McCain, over the last decade, has been on about 150 times, much more than any other person. There's all kinds of ways in which he was ubiquitous in the time between his presidential runs. So that does play a part in it. And the whole Straight Talk Express thing really is the most important piece of John McCain's strategy. He had a realization somewhere around the early, late 1980s, early 1990s, probably after the Keating Five scandal, if you really want to look at where his relationship with the media started to change. That concluded in 1991. And McCain, I think, figured out that the normal relationship between reporters and politicians was dysfunctional, and it didn't serve the politicians well. What often happens is the politicians are very guarded around reporters because they're always afraid they're going to say something that's going to get them in trouble and become controversial, and so they tend to be very careful and measured in what they say, repeat their talking points. McCain realized that he could do something that looked like a risk but in fact didn't turn out to be a risk, which was that he would be completely open with them. Not only would he talk to them for hours, never go off the record, but he would treat them as though he liked them and respected what they do. And so what he found over time was that giving them this access and treating them like he was their best buddy yielded an extraordinary reservoir of goodwill that he could draw on. And so that when he does say something that would get a different politician in trouble, they don't jump on it. They let it pass. So, for instance, in 2000, on the Straight Talk Express, he a couple of times referred to Vietnamese as gooks. Now,
really?
A different politician would have gotten, it would have been deadly. Look at what happened to George Allen in Virginia with saying McConnell.
Sure.
But the reporters who heard it didn't do what they would have done had it been a different politician, which is rush to their laptops, call up their editors on the phone and say, oh, we got a big story. They said, oh, well, you know, that's McCain. Yeah, you know, he was a war hero. We're going to give him a pass. And it was completely ignored. And that's what you see time and time again. When McCain does things that would get different politicians in trouble, the reporters either ignore it or they find ways to explain it away.
You know, it's interesting when you talk about referring to Vietnamese as gooks. It's said by some, and you have to really read between the lines to find this out, but that John McCain has one of the foulest mouths of a politician since Richard Nixon, or I guess more recently Dick Cheney, that he's constantly using swear words, and of course you mentioned the term gooks. And of course Nixon, when those tapes came out, of course it was after the fact, clearly was pilloried for his use of language. John McCain apparently has a nasty temper, but I don't really hear any examples of it from the press.
No, you find references to it every now and again, but most of the time, mostly it's been it's been overlooked. And it is, you know, again, if you look at a lot of the reporting on McCain, you'd think the fact that he was a POW is the entire story of his character, the beginning, middle, and end. But that's a part of it. This is a part of his character too. The fact is that John McCain has a volcanic temper, and both Arizona and Washington D.C. are littered with people whom he has exploded at and insulted.
Can you give me some examples, Paul?
You have people like. It's not only it's politicians, even members of his own party. There are a number of stories that, you know, he can't say on the radio because they involve his swearing at other members of the Republican Party, members of the Democratic Party, other senators that he's had confrontations with, where even some of his Republican colleagues say they wouldn't want his finger on the trigger. There are Arizona politicians, former governors that he's had clashes with, former staff members to other members of Congress.
Paul, let me ask you about some specific rumors, if I can, because I want to know if these are true or false. It's been reported that he actually had a physical fight with Rick Renzi. Is that right?
You know, I'm not sure about the Rick Renzi story.
Okay.
Let
me ask you another story. One you can confirm or deny. It's been reported that he called his own wife a four-letter word beginning with C that we shouldn't talk about women in 1992. Is that true?
Well, the person who reports that story, Cliff Schechter, says that he had three different reporters who are Arizona reporters who told him this story but would not do it, but wouldn't let their names be used. So, you know, I know Cliff, and I know that he wouldn't put that out there unless he had actually had it on authority. And the three different sources, you know, they're anonymous sources. Some people are going to say, well, you know, if you rely on anonymous sources for that, then you shouldn't be putting it in your book.
I just want some examples. I mean, people say a volcanic temper. When you think of that, what comes to your mind? Something specific?
Well, you can there. If you go to our book, we have a whole series of these that goes on for pages and pages. You know, there's a story about his first Senate race in 1986 where a volunteer for the Senate on his Senate campaign set up the podium too high, and McCain is he's kind of a short guy, and
right.
Apparently he was just a volunteer, and he started yelling and screaming at this kid, you know, in full view of other people. There are politicians, you know, Jane Hull, the former governor of Arizona, once joked that the way you have to talk to McCain on the phone is by holding it, you know, a foot away from your head while he screams at you. There are all kinds of stories like this about, you know, him threatening people when they for supporting people who he didn't support, saying that
threatening
he's gonna destroy their
how?
Careers.
Destroy their careers.
Basically, like you'll never work in this town again, sort of threats. You know, that's, again, this is part of McCain's story. It's not the entirety of his character isn't summed up by the fact that he was a POW in Vietnam. That's part of his story, but these things are part of his story too.
Let me get to some of the specifics on his policy, because the other thing, of course, that he's famous for is, you know, standing on principle. Even when it's, you know, Americans don't agree, he's someone who will stand. He won't flip-flop. And yet, when we look at anything from his position on taxes to the religious right, to immigration, to the war in Iraq, to abortion, to even ethanol, this is a guy who seems to regularly flip-flop. I can imagine the Kerry commercial with the windsurfer, I don't know, something new, maybe flapjacks or something for John McCain. Let's go through some of these more famous flip-flops. The one that I can think of that immediately comes to mind is when he called Jerry Falwell an agent of intolerance in 2000, and then embraced the man in 2008.
Right. So wasn't supported by the religious right in 2000. They were behind George W. Bush. And he called Jerry Falwell and Pat Robertson agents of intolerance. And then when he started to run in 2008, really in 2006 and 2007, as his campaign was gearing up, he decided he was going to be the establishment Republican candidate. And that meant not only going after all the Bush fundraisers and Bush staffers, but also cozying up to people like Jerry Falwell. He went and gave a commencement speech at Falwell's Liberty University, and when asked if he still thought Falwell was an agent of intolerance, he said no. He has also sought out and gotten the support of a lot of incredibly radical fundamentalist ministers, like John Hagee, who is McCain went down to San Antonio a couple of times to try to get his support. For those people who don't know, he is the pastor of a megachurch in San Antonio. He's written a lot of books about, he's basically a premillennial dispensationalist, which means that he's awaiting Armageddon, and he has publicly said many times that the United States should invade Iran in order to hasten the coming of Armageddon.
He's also called the Catholic Church, I think, the Great Whore or something like that.
And said that, you know, anti-Semitism is a Jew's own fault because of what they did to Jesus.
Because, right. But let me ask you this, because the media was all over Jeremiah Wright, and we all know that. Because Obama did Obama sufficiently distance himself, or didn't he? That was the great question. It probably still is in media sources. But they've hardly focused on John McCain's ties to, I mean, for example, to Pastor John Hagee. You mentioned he specifically went out and sought his support. This isn't just some crazy preacher supporting John McCain. John McCain went and sought his support. Is that right?
Right. Yeah, he went down, took trips down to San Antonio a couple of times to try to get his endorsement, eventually got his endorsement, had a big press conference announcing it. And, you know, if you ask reporters about that, they'll say, oh, well, you know, McCain doesn't really believe what those guys believe. He's just doing that to secure his base. But yet the paradox, I think it doesn't make any sense, is on the one hand, as you said, part of the storyline about John McCain is that he's the one who doesn't do anything for political reasons. He's the guy who stands on integrity. He's all about principle. And yet when he does these things, when he panders to the religious right for political reasons, the explanation is, well, you know, that's just what the process requires. That doesn't really make him a panderer. It doesn't make him a flip-flopper when he flip-flops, because we know that John McCain's heart is pure and that he's the one honor roll man in Washington. So when he does those things that we'll blame other politicians for, that doesn't really reflect on his character. He's just doing what he has to do. And then once the primaries are over and he's secured that base, then he'll go back to being the honorable man that we all know and love.
Has anyone in the press called on him to distance himself from these radical preachers?
There's been some very gentle questioning, and he says, "Oh well, you know, I don't believe everything that he believes," and then that's satisfactory as far as the reporters are concerned.
Interesting, because Obama has to give a huge speech on it. Let me go to another flip flop. This one was interesting because McCain on the Confederate flag in South Carolina. This is back in 2000. First, he says, "You know, I that's not really his issue." Then he completely panders to South Carolinians and supports their use of the Confederate flag, and then later on, he goes on the press and admits he was a panderer, admits that he just said what they wanted him to say, and he's treated as a hero for having admitted his own flip-flop.
Yeah,
did I get that right?
It's absolutely brilliant, and McCain knew exactly what he was doing with this. First, he came out and said that he really thought it was a symbol of intolerance. Then, you know, the South Carolina primary was sort of the linchpin of the 2000 Republican contest. He changed his position and took the position that the people of South Carolina have to decide for themselves. That's the pro-Confederate flag position, and that's the position that Bush had as well. Then after the elections are over, he says to a reporter that, yeah, you know, he only did that for political reasons, and it really was cowardly, and that he wished he hadn't have done it. Now you can give him credit for admitting that he did something for political reasons, but he also really understands the value of that sort of apology, because what happened? Well, then he got all kinds of praise from reporters for admitting that he had done something for political reasons. Now, I've never seen an occasion where he made some kind of blatantly political move and then came out and said, boy, that was really successful, and it was completely political what I did. It's only the times when it fails like that he can then come out and say, boy, you know, that was really a mistake. And then he'll get the credit for reporters for being the lone politician who will actually admit to, you know, having done something for political reasons. And then they go right back to saying that he's the one who doesn't do things for political reasons,
even though he's even admitted to it. It's an amazing thing. Let's talk specifically about some policy flip-flops. He flip-flopped on taxes. He was against Bush's tax cuts before he was for Bush's tax cuts. Again, he seems to get a pass on this?
Absolutely. When they ran in 2000, they both had tax cut plans, and he criticized Bush's plan by saying it was too geared to the wealthy. Then when the election was over and Bush very quickly brought that plan in pretty much the form he had advocated during the campaign, up for a vote. McCain voted against it, which would be consistent with his opposition to it. Now, today, he says that he wants to make Bush's tax cuts permanent, and he has also not been completely honest about what his objections to them were. Now he says that the reason that he opposed the Bush tax cuts was because they weren't offset by spending cuts. But at the same time, if you look back at the record, that's not what he said at the time. That wasn't the basis of his opposition at all. So,
and in, he's flip-flopped on immigration with regard to supporting the Bush plan and then saying, well, he wants a fence first. Even on abortion, this one surprised me, which I was reading about, that he has said that he doesn't want to repeal Roe v. Wade, but then he has a zero rating on every abortion bill that comes before Congress. And then he tells religious right people he's going to appoint people who will overturn Roe v. Wade.
Yeah, he's been kind of all over the map on that question, on the very specific question of Roe v. Wade. And even though he's got basically a perfect pro-life voting record, he at one point said that, oh, you know, we shouldn't repeal Roe v. Wade because then people will be getting back on the abortions. Immediately they realized that was the wrong thing to say given what the Republican base wants. And so then he came out and said, no, I want to repeal Roe v. Wade. In 2000, he got endorsed by Gary Bauer, who is a very well-known religious right leader. And when people asked why, Bauer said that he asked George Bush if he would pledge to him, to Bauer, to appoint only pro-life judges. And Bush wouldn't do it. He just said, I'm going to appoint people who will, uphold the Constitution. But when he asked McCain, McCain said, yes, I will appoint only pro-life judges. And that's why Bauer endorsed McCain. So
he's been completely inconsistent on this then. I mean, he said a pro-life judge means someone to repeal Roe v. Wade, right?
Exactly. And so his statements about Roe v. Wade, he's basically like jumped around trying to jump through the hoops that the religious right wants. But if you look at his voting record, he has a pretty consistent pro-life voting record.
Now, he's known as a politician who works with Democrats. This is sort of part of his moderate lingo. And, I think part of the thing is that he is more moderate than George Bush, but that's not saying much. Just about every, dog and cat in the United States is more moderate than George Bush. But one of the things that you point out in your book is that there are definitely Republicans like Maine senators, Olympia Snowe or Susan Collins, that work with Democrats a lot more than John McCain.
Yeah, John McCain votes with the Republicans about 85% of the time, which puts him pretty much in the middle of the pack among Republican senators. But there's something different that happens in the media on those occasions where he does break with his party. Now, every senator, no matter how conservative or how liberal, breaks with their party sometimes. And there are people in the Republican Party and people in the Democratic Party who do it much more often than John McCain does. But if somebody like Olympia Snowe, who's a moderate Republican senator from Maine, if she decides that she's going to vote with Democrats on something, it doesn't change the story that the press tells about that issue. They're still going to portray it as a conflict between Democrats and Republicans. But if John McCain is the one who decides this time he's going to vote with Democrats, it completely transforms the press coverage of that issue. All of a sudden, it's no longer a conflict between Democrats and Republicans. The Democrats disappear entirely. The story becomes John McCain and his courageous rebellion. And he is the one who's in the headlines. It gets on the front page. He's the one who is quoted in all the stories, who gets to go on Meet the Press and talk about it. It completely changes the story that the press tells. So even if these occasions are few and far between, it reinforces the impression that somehow he's going against his party more often than other people do, when in fact that's not the case. It's just that the press pays a lot more attention when he does it.
Again, the question is why. I mean, you say he's in the middle of the pack, 85% voting with his Republicans. Is it because of his stand on campaign finance reform that he's known as a reformer? Is that it, the McCain-Feingold bill, the reason why when John McCain differs from his Republican colleagues, he's treated differently from a Susan Collins or an Olympia Snowe?
I think that McCain-Feingold had a lot to do with it. It's sort of passed from memory by now. But it was an issue for a long, long time. And the political press was almost universal in their admiration of that bill and the larger goal of taking money out of politics. If you look at the coverage of that, it really is that what we compare it to is that, there's that old expression that laws and sausages are the two things one should never watch being made. Well, the political reporters are the people who prowl the halls of the sausage factory. And the McCain-Feingold bill became kind of a way for them to talk about their disgust with money in politics and people wielding influence and the special interests and all that. And in that story, it became a story of this lone crusader, this heroic Don Quixote figure, John McCain, who was facing off against this corrupt system. Even if he wasn't really all that lonely, you know, almost the entirety of the Democratic Party was with him on that. And in the end, it ended up helping Republicans more than helping Democrats, which he knew very well. Because
the Democrats got more soft money than Republicans did.
Right. The McCain-Feingold bill did a couple things. The big thing was that it outlawed soft money, which were large unregulated contributions to political parties. At the time, the Democratic Party was much more reliant on those large contributions than the Republican Party, which had a lot of wealthy donors who would give $5,000, $10,000, $20,000, but the Democratic Party had some people and some labor unions, for instance, who would give $100,000, $200,000 to their party, and they were much more reliant on that than the Republicans were. So in private, Republicans used to refer to McCain-Feingold as the Democratic Party suicide bill, because the Democrats all supported it, even though it was going to hurt them. The other thing that happened, right at the end, McCain consented to a Republican demand to increase the allowable contributions to candidates from $1,000 to $2,000 and peg them to inflation. So that meant that wealthy donors could give even more. Now today, it's seven years after the passage of McCain-Feingold. Nobody thinks that it succeeded in taking money out of politics. If anything, there's much, much more money in politics than there used to be.
Let me take a quick break. There's so many things to talk about. We have, of course, John McCain on the war on Iraq. That is the thing he's most famous for, though he's promised, at least in a joke, to bomb Iran as well. There is his whole association with lobbyists who are full of his campaign. A Free Ride, the book that Paul Waldman writes with David Brock, goes into a lot of detail on how it is that all these lobbyists have come to support John McCain. And then there's his position on all kinds of issues where you may surprise you that, guess what, he's got the same position as every Republican, from privatizing Social Security to being against gay rights, against labor rights, for assault weapons, and all the same, even for supporting the Ten Commandments or creationism in schools. A lot more to talk about. I also want to take your calls at 877-4-HEAD-ON, 877-443-2366. We'll be right back after this.
I'm Matt Rothschild, the editor of the Progressive magazine, with my progressive point of view, which you can also grab off our website over at progressive.org. I saw General Petraeus' testimony to the Senate, and what jumped out at me was the bellicose comments he made about Iran. Several times in his morning testimony, he alleged that Iran was funding, training, and equipping Shiite groups in Iraq. He said that Iran was behind the recent launching of the rockets into the Green Zone. He added that we need to watch Iranian actions closely and that the situation was, in his words, exceedingly complex and challenging in Iraq, in part because Iran could stoke more violence. One reason we need to stay in Iraq, he insisted, is to resist Iranian encroachment in the Middle East. This testimony, taken as a whole, is nothing but a prelude to Bush's bombing of Iran. And no, it's not going to be primarily about the distant threat of Iran's nuclear capabilities. The NIE shelved that one. But Bush is fully capable of grabbing another pretext off the shelf, and Petraeus has already applied his yellow magic marker to the serviceable lines. And even Bush knows how to read those. I'm Matt Rothschild, and that's how I see it.
Hi, I'm Joanne Woodward. Ever notice how many things happen in a circle? The seasons, the spinning of the circle we call Earth, and recycling. The circle starts when we recycle trash. It's completed when we buy products made from recycled materials. Check the label for something called post-consumer recycled content. Then buy the highest percentage of it. Complete the circle.
For your free Buy Recycled shopping guide, call 1-800-2-RECYCLE. A message from the Ad Council and Environmental Defense. Finding the ways that work.
From Washington, more of the Inside Scoop with Mark Levine.
Welcome back to the Inside Scoop. My guest today is Paul Waldman. He's the author, along with David Brock, of Free Ride, John McCain and the Media. John McCain, of course, has gotten a very, very kind treatment from the media, but we're talking about all the ways in which he has flip-flopped and he has not discussed, he has not been disclosed, let's say, as the violent temper and all the other things that he has. We're going to get to his lobbyist connections in just a minute. First, let me get to the phone. Sarge from Mississippi, welcome to the Inside Scoop.
Right, it's Sarge from Arizona now. I've been out here about a year, Mark.
Oh, okay. Well, welcome, Sarge. How are you?
Doing fine. On McCain, I got an interesting, there's several interesting things I could tell you about McCain, but one thing out here in Phoenix, there's a air service that does a lot of his transportation, and they say when he comes out there that he cusses them, he is very rude, and they really just hate to see him come. He has got such a violent temper and such a vile nature. And talking with some of the people with the Arizona Republic newspaper here, they don't give him too favorable of a treatment. He's pretty well wore his welcome out here.
Well, let me ask ask Paul about that, Sarge. One second. I want to ask Paul, because, Paul, one of the things you point out in your book is that in his home state of Arizona, John McCain is not the hero that he is in Washington, D.C.
Well, yeah, it's a very interesting kind of contrast. You know, the Arizona Republic is a fairly conservative newspaper, but nonetheless, he's had a stormy relationship with them and with the Arizona media as a whole. What you find there is that it's a kind of warts and all portrait that's given by the reporters that know him best and have known him the longest. And as a consequence, his relationship with them is extremely contentious because he doesn't cotton too well to being criticized and having that kind of more complete vision of him put forward in front of readers and viewers and listeners. And so
what do they know? What do the Arizona people know that the Washington people don't know?
You know, the interesting thing is I don't know that they necessarily know. It's not as though there are secrets that the National Press Corps is unaware of. It's just that they have been charmed by McCain to the extent that they're not going to talk about things like his terrible temper, which gets talked about much more in the Arizona press.
Thank you for your call, Sarge. I appreciate that. Let me ask you about the war in Iraq, because obviously you can't talk about John McCain very much without going into the war in Iraq. I mean, it's the thing that he has sold his whole campaign on, if you will. Now, early on, John McCain said the war would be easy. And then recently he's been saying, oh, all these people that said it would be easy were just wrong. The media doesn't seem to have caught his early comments on that.
No, and you know they've entirely bought the story that he has told on this, which is that he has been a constant critic of the war from the beginning. But that's not really true. During the run-up to the war, the things that John McCain was saying were exactly the same as the things that George Bush and Dick Cheney were saying. He said we'd be greeted as liberators, that the war would be easy, and he was very critical of people who were opposed to the war. So even though, you know, as it went on, he began to be a little more critical of the strategy that was being employed, it's not true that he has always been a fierce critic of the war. But that's what you would believe if you read some of the coverage of him.
Well, even today, he clearly says that the war was a good idea. In other words, that he's not one of those people that says, as many do, well, I supported it at the beginning, but I didn't realize they didn't have WMDs and they didn't have connections with Al-Qaeda, and it was a mistake in retrospect. He says, basically, if he had to do it all over again, he would have done it all over again, right?
Absolutely. And so he's not basically his objections, such as they were tactical. Not that it was a bad idea, but just that, you know, we could have employed better tactics.
But the thing is that when he said early on that the war would be easy, and that's the word he used, easy, why hasn't the media picked up on the fact that, hey, he was wrong?
I think that, you could come up with a number of explanations, but I think that the fact that he made some of those tactical criticisms cemented in their idea that he had, in their minds, the idea that he's been a critic from the beginning and was always a critic because, you know, so many of the people in Washington, Republicans, were such staunch supporters of the Bush administration on Iraq that, you know, they would explain away anything and not brook any kind of criticism whatsoever of the administration. And McCain kind of found that place where he could offer some minor criticisms of specific tactics being employed without ever coming out against the entire endeavor. You know, whether that position is sincere or not, who knows? But So I think in their minds, as with so many other things, they've decided that McCain is just different, that he stands outside of partisanship and he solely rests on principle. And if the facts get in the way of that, then the facts will be ignored.
Now, is he the author of the surge, as he seems to claim to be, and is that a good thing or a bad thing?
Well, I guess it depends on what you consider authorship to be. I mean, he certainly was calling for more troops to be sent to Iraq. In that sense, he was the earliest supporter, certainly, of that strategy of sending more troops to Iraq. Now, you know, there are... right now, I think that he may be getting in trouble because he's so adamant that the surge has been a smashing success. When anybody who knows anything about what's going on in Iraq knows that in a fundamental way, it's been a failure. It's not that they haven't succeeded in making some reductions in violence, but the whole point of the surge was supposed to be that it would give the space for there to be political reconciliation in Iraq, and that hasn't happened at all. We are still
now, of course,
refereeing the civil war there.
Right. John McCain's most famous statement, the one most often repeated by Democrats, is that we could be in Iraq for 100 years. Now, a number of Republicans have complained that what he meant was 100 years like South Korea or Germany or Japan, where there would be no more, you know, military fighting, but we would have troops stationed there. Does he really think that we're going to have a peaceful 100 years in Iraq? What's the fair way to discuss John McCain in the 100-year comment?
I think the fair way to characterize what he thinks is that we have to stay in Iraq as long as it takes to turn it into a gentle and calm democracy, no matter how long that takes. And he believes that that there's nothing wrong with us establishing a permanent base in Iraq, which the Bush administration is already trying to negotiate, he doesn't seem to see that there's any kind of problem with that, when, of course, one of the problems with having a permanent base in the Muslim world is that it tends to exacerbate anti-American feelings. I mean, look at this. Even the Bush administration realized that the fact that we had troops stationed in Saudi Arabia was a problem. Now, and this is one of the interesting kind of sidelights to this, is they're always complaining that one of the things you often hear McCain and other people say is that, if we leave Iraq, Al-Qaeda will just declare victory, and that's a terrible thing. We can't give them the satisfaction. Osama bin Laden had said many times that one of his biggest problems with the U.S. was that we had troops in the Muslim Holy Land in Saudi Arabia. Well, George Bush removed those troops in 2003. Now, they weren't worried about the fact that bin Laden would declare victory or be happy about it. They realized that it was a problem having troops in Saudi Arabia. It stirred up anti-Americanism. Even George Bush realized that.
I find that when things are going well in Iraq, they say, see, there, the surge is justified. We need more troops in Iraq. And when things are going badly in Iraq, they say, things are going badly, so we need more troops in Iraq in order to fight the things that are going badly. So whether they go badly or well, either way, we need more troops in Iraq. And now, at least as a joke, John McCain has talked about bombing Iran. I know that one general, I think it was Cody was the name, who said, we just don't have the power, we don't have the resources with our all-volunteer army to do all these things. But when he made his joke, bomb Iran, and why didn't – does he get away with things like that in a way that other politicians don't?
He absolutely does. And think about what happened a couple of weeks ago where he said, I believe, three or four times that Iran was training Al-Qaeda in order to stir things up in Iraq. Well, that's like saying that the Yankees are training the Red Sox.
Right.
And if it had been a different candidate, if it had been Barack Obama, say, what would reporters have said? Well, they would have said, well, this raises serious questions about whether or not he has the experience and knowledge to be commander-in-chief.
Sure. And the fact that Joe Lieberman had to correct him. But now it's interesting on this because John McCain, I can't quite tell what his position is. Half of him seems to say, I just misspoke. But then he said it four or five or six times. I don't know how you misspeak that many times.
And the position of the press as well. We all know that John McCain is experienced and knowledgeable on foreign affairs, so he must have just misspoke. It must have just been a mistake. Maybe some person said, he hadn't enough coffee, or maybe he was jet-lagged. The idea that maybe he has an overly simplistic view of what's going on in the Middle East, didn't really enter their mind. And this is really important because that kind of overly simplistic view is what got us into Iraq in the first place. I mean, let's remember that George Bush was arguing that revenge for September 11th could reasonably be exacted on Saddam Hussein because, well,
right.
You know, he's a bad guy and Al-Qaeda are bad guys, so they must be working together. That seems to there's at least a possibility that McCain has some kind of similar view with regard to Iran and Al-Qaeda, that they're all bad guys, so they must be working together. Well, if you think that, then you don't have a good enough understanding of what's going on in the Middle East, and that raises serious questions about what sort of strategy you're going to employ in order to fight terrorism, in order to get us out of Iraq, etc. But those sorts of questions were not raised when it came to John McCain, because there's just an assumption on the press that, well, you know, he understands these things really well. And so when he says things like that, it doesn't change their view of him. They don't update their view based on the things that he says and does. Their view of him is locked in place.
Well, I definitely would be remiss if we didn't talk in this hour about John McCain and the Keating Five and his ties to lobbyists, because this is a man who constantly says that he is against the special interests, that he's the person who, I can't recall how many times he said that, you know, special interests don't support him. And yet, as you point out in your book, there it seems like every oil company and pharmaceutical company and telecommunications company and insurance company and defense company and chemical company, they have lobbyists working on his staff. What is John McCain? First of all, I guess, let's start with the Keating Five. What exactly did happen with Charles Keating in the savings and loan crisis? And then let's update today to his ties to lobbyists. Let's start with the Keating Five.
Okay, before we get to the Keating Five, I should mention, if people want to go to McCainsFreeRide.com, we have a huge chart that shows all the different lobbyists who are working for McCain right now, which we'll get to.
But perfect.
The story with the Keating Five was, people might remember the savings and loan scandal cost the American taxpayer a couple of $100 billion. The worst offender in that scandal was a man named Charles Keating, who owned SNL in Arizona. He was a longtime friend of John McCain's. He had flown McCain and his family out to his house in the Bahamas a few times. McCain failed to report that in violation of congressional rules. He was a big patron of John McCain's and a good personal friend. Cindy McCain and her father even went in on investments with Charles Keating. And when the scandal began to brew and Keating's SNL began to go down in flames, he asked McCain and four other senators if they would intervene with federal regulators to put pressure on them to ease up on their investigation of Keating. These senators did so.
John McCain did so too.
He went to a couple meetings where they put pressure on the federal regulators not to investigate Keating. He got off with a reprimand from the Senate. And the interesting thing about that is that the story that the press tells about it these days is a redemption story, that he sinned and then was reborn as a reformer and would sin no more. Well,
now, he was formally reprimanded. I want to make this clear to listeners, because a formal reprimand, what you're saying, correct me if I'm wrong, is that the entire Senate voted to reprimand John McCain. That's got to be a rare event. In fact, the only thing more serious than reprimand, I think, is censure, and then worse than that is expulsion. But this is, I mean, the entire Senate voted to condemn John McCain. Is that right?
Yeah, and the other senators, some of them got more serious reprimands than he did, but basically, you know, there was a general acknowledgement that they had stepped over the line. Now, as I said, the story that we're told now about that is that was the old John McCain, that he's now reborn as the reformer. But if you actually look at what's happened in the 18 years or so since the Keating Five came down, what you find is that he has been as entwined with the special interests as anybody else in Washington. He's gotten oodles of money from people from corporations that had legislation before the Commerce Committee, which he chaired for many years and which he still sits on. And if you look, for instance, people might remember not too long ago there was a story in the New York Times that contained this sort of salacious allegation that he might have had an affair with a lobbyist. Now, what got lost in that controversy was the meat of that story, which no other major news organizations have followed up on to any extent. What it was about was a company called Paxson Communications. In this instance, McCain did almost exactly the same thing as he had in Keating 5 10 years later. So what happened? Paxson Communications gave him $20,000 in contributions, them and their attorneys. They were flying him around the country on their corporate jet, and the chairman of the company, Bud Paxson, implored him to intervene with the Federal Communications Commission over the sale of a television station that they needed to get approved. And McCain had, at the very least, a good friendship with Paxson's lobbyist. McCain at first denied that that meeting with Bud Paxton had ever taken place. Then when proof of it that it had happened came out, he admitted that, yes, in fact, he wasn't telling the truth, that the meeting had taken place. After he met with Paxton, McCain sent two letters to the FCC imploring them to come to a decision on this. The chairman of the FCC said it was improper that he was doing that. So what we see is almost a carbon copy of what got him in so much trouble in the Keating Five scandal. A big contributor and someone who he had all kinds of relationships with was trying to get him to intervene with federal regulators on their behalf. But that didn't really go along with the story that the press has been telling about John McCain, which is that he's the reformer, he's the guy who stands up to the special interests, he's the lobbyist's enemy, but that's not really true. And if you look at his current campaign, what do you find? Well, his campaign manager is a corporate lobbyist, his deputy campaign manager is a corporate lobbyist, his campaign co-chair is a corporate lobbyist, his chief fundraiser is a corporate lobbyist, his chief political advisor is a corporate lobbyist. It is extraordinary how many corporate lobbyists he's managed to put on his campaign staff. But yet, that is not something that has gotten him much criticism from the press, because their idea about who he is really locked in stone, that he's the guy who stands up to the special interest. So if the facts don't go
along
with
the companies
get ignored.
I was going to say, all the companies, all the people that you mentioned, you know, Rick Davis, all his campaign manager, his deputy campaign manager, all of them seem to represent the exact same corporations that people fear in the Bush administration. You know, oil companies, telecommunications companies, pharmaceutical companies, defense companies. Is there any reason to believe he'd be any different toward these major corporations who are getting so much corporate welfare than George Bush is?
Well, the question hasn't really been asked, and until it's investigated and he gets asked about it, we look at who these people's clients are and what they're expecting to get, then I don't think we're going to know the answer to that. But if it were a different candidate, those questions would be being asked, those relationships would be investigated. But they're not, because it's John McCain who is the press's favorite politician.
Well, it's striking to me, for example, that Hillary Clinton definitely has some lobbyists, though it doesn't appear as many as John McCain. And her ties and Bill Clinton's ties to these people are being raised every day in the press. Are John McCain's ties to lobbyists more serious or more severe, or has he given more favor to his people than, say, Hillary Clinton?
I think there are certainly more lobbyists working for him than for any other candidate. But the difference is that I think there's kind of a base assumption with Clinton, especially, that any relationship that she has is there's something sinister about it. And if someone has given her money, then they must have gotten some kind of a favor. There's kind of a baseline with both Clintons, frankly, that there's always something sinister going on behind the scenes. The baseline assumption among reporters about John McCain is that he is as pure as the driven snow. And if there are lobbyists working for him, well, then obviously McCain is so principled and so full of integrity that he would never let any influence be exercised on him. So you really find that the reporters are going into that story with a fundamentally different outlook on who he is versus who other people are. And that,
Paul, give my listeners some ammunition, if you will. You mentioned Charles Keating. You mentioned, is it Charles Paxton? Give me some more shady characters, if you will, around John McCain. We all know about Jeremiah Wright. We all know about the Clintons. Tell us some names we should know. Vicky Eisman, who should we know when worrying about John McCain and his, let's say, not as stellar image as he'd like us to believe?
Well, if you look at some of his main people, his campaign manager, Rick Davis, was a corporate lobbyist. Or is a corporate lobbyist, and represented a lot of corporations that had interest before the Commerce Committee, which McCain chaired, and that's probably why they hired Rick Davis, because he had a long-standing relationship with John McCain. His senior political advisor, Charlie Black, may be one of the top three or four corporate lobbyists in Washington. He's taken a temporary leave from his lobbying firm. There are few power brokers in Washington whom the corporations turn to more than Charlie Black, and he's McCain's senior political advisor.
So with John McCain, government is by the corporations for the corporations of the corporations.
Well,
I mean, is it fair to say he's a corporate-owned structure?
Well, you can characterize it that way if you want. I think that the big question is, what are these people's clients going to be getting if he becomes the president? But people don't ask that question of John McCain, and if he gets asked, he dismisses it with a wave of the hand, and they accept that dismissal because there's an assumption that he's the kind of guy who wouldn't allow that sort of influence to be exercised on him. But the record shows that that's not really true. I mean, the Paxton case is a perfect example. People who had insider connections to John McCain got what they wanted. And they're giving him money and flying him around in their corporate jet. You know, for a lot of politicians, people would say, well, you know, that's just the way things work in Washington. But he's supposed to be different. We've been told that he's different. But, in fact, he's not really different.
Now, his wife, Cindy McCain, is an heiress to a beer fortune. Is that right?
Yeah, a beer distribution fortune.
And apparently he's been helping out the beer industry as well. Tell us what you know about that.
Well, Cindy McCain, you know, it's another one of the interesting sidelines. Remember with John Kerry how we were told a lot that he was sort of emasculated by the fact that he
right.
had a wealthy wife.
Right.
Nobody talks about the fact that Cindy McCain is worth probably something in the area of $100 million. Her father was one of the largest beer distributorships in America. And McCain has said when he got elected to Congress that he was going to recuse himself from any kind of vote or anything on any matters that have to do with alcohol. And he basically has kept it up for the most part. There have been some things that where the lines weren't so clear. But I think that it's another one of the interesting things about John McCain that just really hasn't been investigated, hasn't been discussed, where, you know, the rules are really different for him. You know, one of my favorite things that happened recently, McCain had this little barbecue out on his ranch for a bunch of national reporters. If you go to YouTube and search on Meghan McCain, his daughter, you can see a video she put up of everybody having a great old time at the McCain Ranch. So, you know, he's cooking up the ribs and the reporters are all eating them up. Some reporters even bought flowers for Cindy. It's all very cozy. But one of the most amusing things about it was that there were some stories about this little get-together afterward. And a lot of them refer to McCain's quote-unquote rustic cabin in the Arizona hills. And it turns out that his rustic cabin, you think rustic cabin, does it have plumbing?
Right.
Room? It's a compound with three or four different buildings. There's a main house and a guest house and a third house. It's a huge ranch compound worth millions of dollars. But the idea that John McCain is some kind of wealthy swell who can't relate to ordinary folks is not something that is ever raised. You know, when the
no, it isn't. I mean, I can think of. Yeah, I can think of John Kerry. I think of what they said about John Edwards and his haircut. It seems they always want to make them as, you know, these wealthy people. Apparently, John McCain's wealth dwarfs them all.
Yeah, and when the Clintons released their tax returns last week, that was a lot of the discussion. Well, you know, they earned so much money in the last 10 years. How can they relate to regular folks? Isn't this going to be a problem for Hillary Clinton in Pennsylvania? Nobody ever asks if the fact that John McCain's wife is worth $100 million means that he's not going to be able to relate to regular folks. I think there's kind of a default assumption on the part of a lot of the press that Republicans are the ones who can relate to regular folks. And that's just who they are, no matter how wealthy they are, and Democrats can't.
We're coming up on the end of the hour, and I just want to go very, very quickly, because there's so much to talk about, just on his positions that may surprise people. So you can just sort of say check or yes, unless there needs to be an explanation. He doesn't want to support the assault weapons ban, right?
That's true.
Okay. He wants to privatize Social Security. Is that right?
Yes, he does.
He believes that creationism should be taught in schools if local schools want that.
He flip-flopped around on that a little bit. It's a little hard to tell what he thinks, but he has in the past said that intelligent design, which is basically creationism under another name, should be taught.
He supports the posting of the Ten Commandments.
Yep.
He is against a lot of labor rights, labor bills, things that help labor.
Yeah, he has been on any number of things.
He's against hate crimes bills.
That's true.
And surprisingly, he's even against the GI Bill to help veterans, which is, am I right about that?
The ones that Democrats are proposing now, yes.
That's what I thought. So there's a lot of things that people should know about John McCain. Tell us again your website, Paul.
It is McCainsFreeRide.com.
McCainsFreeRide.com. Paul Waldman, thank you very much for coming here on The Inside Scoop.
It's been my pleasure.
It's been my pleasure as well. There was a lot of information in an hour. I think Paul was a terrific guest, and I would recommend very much getting his book. You know, it's amazing how much of a free ride that John McCain has gotten, and this is a way that when you have a friend who says they support John McCain, and we all have them, we have to admit it, there are people out there, friends and family, you can say, well, what about this? What about that? And hopefully this show itself can be an archive, can be a resource for you to use in case you want to go and find out about the real John McCain. Tune in tomorrow. We've got a terrific show on the cost of the Iraq War. You won't want to miss that. But for now, this is Mark Levine signing off.